I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets. My name is Paul Hill. I'm delighted today to be able to host the first Macro Investing Masterclass of 2024 with two distinguished capital markets experts, namely Patrick Armstrong, CIO at Plumini Wealth, and Harry Covin of Longview Economics, senior market strategist there. So welcome, gents.
Happy New Year.
Yeah. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, well, big warm welcome there, Harry, for the first one to join this round table. And let's sort of throw you into the deep end right at the start. So given that sort of inflation is starting to roll over, but the markets, particularly the bond markets, are pricing in some pretty steep interest rate cuts for this year, what's your sort of overall view of the sort of like the economy, the capital markets, and also the sort of equities for the rest of the year?
Yeah, great question. I mean, we were pretty worried about recession last year. We've somewhat recently downgraded recession risk, though. So we thought it was more than 50% chance we'd get a recession in the US in 24. Actually, I think it's more like 30%. So it's not completely off the table. But one of the ways we like to think about recession risk is that if you look through history, recessions are all preceded by a combination of one or more of three factors. Either it's tight money and or it's some sort of shock, some sort of macro shock, and or it's a corporate sector that's overstretched. And if you look at the corporate sector in the US, it's in reasonably good shape. That's always, I think, been the risk to this recession view that we and many others have had. In terms of shocks, well, there isn't really, I would argue, there aren't any macro shocks at play at the moment. And then in terms of tight money, I think the Fed changed all of that in December. We had pretty dramatic change, shift in Fed policy from higher for longer to talking about cuts this year. And that for us really moved the needle. And I think it's generating a lot of loosening in financial conditions. That should feed through into looser credit conditions. That's historically the relationship. And that should bring about a turn in the credit cycle. And also a turn in the housing market, which has been very deeply depressed and detracting from growth. Probably that will start to add to growth. So I think actually probably the outlook for the US is pretty good. And therefore, we have a reasonably positive view on many risk assets. I think now's not the time to be taking big bets. As I say, I think there's still a 35% chance of a risk of a recession in 24. So we've got a somewhat balanced portfolio, and we're playing with a few themes, which we can talk about in a moment if you like.
Yeah, and Patrick, just in terms of that sort of the bond market, I mean, the moment the Fed is indicating 75 basis point decrease in interest rates through its dot plot, but the market is baking in around about 5 or potentially 6, and likewise 5 in the UK as well. I mean, is there a disconnect there? Because if we do, if Harry's right, and we have a sort of like a, and we don't have a recession, we've been calling for that recession for 12 months, but we don't ever have that recession, then are we being a bit optimistic in terms of these policymakers absolutely sort of like, you know, putting the foot to the gas and reducing interest rates?
Yeah, I'm of the view that the U.S. doesn't fall into a recession. Consumption remains resilient. The job market remains strong. And it's the job market and wage growth that drives the economy. So if you look at every quintile of earnings in the United States, all of them grew at above 4% earnings growth last year. So it's you're getting wage growth that's above inflation. That's going to drive spending. And you've got a Fed that in December indicated they're not going to make the same mistake every Fed has made since I was born, which is keeping rates too high after the economy's already topped. And basically, Powell's acknowledged central banks have always made that mistake. And he's saying, maybe we're not going to make that mistake this time. So you could almost count on a Fed keeping rates too high, provoking the recession. He's showing an indication now where he is going to at least discuss cuts, and the market's pricing 5 or 6. I don't think it's going to be needed, because if you have a positive economic view, probably what the Fed's saying, 75, is probably about right. So if you've got inflation dissipating, growth remaining strong, you just want to keep the real Fed rate roughly where it is right now, maybe 25 basis points lower than it is right now, because they've acknowledged it is restrictive at this point. But as inflation falls, the current Fed fund rate gets more restrictive because in real terms it's rising. So that's what's going to provoke the cuts. And I think 3 is a pretty reasonable estimate if you don't expect a recession. So that's good news for markets. It's supportive for the economy, but it shouldn't provoke excessive risk-taking that the 5 or 6 that the market's pricing in right now on interest rate probabilities.
Yeah. So Harry, if that's right, if we don't actually get that sort of like reduction in interest rates quite as much as the market, what's going to happen to sort of like equities and bonds? Because logically you'd think that bond prices would sell off as they would reprice, certainly at the short end of the curve. And likewise, equities, anything with long, you know, sort of like, you know, sort of projection, certainly the growth sort of like stocks, et cetera, again, will reprice because the valuations will come down.
Yeah, and no doubt we'll have some of that. You know, these things always play out in chapters, don't they? And markets swing from one view and then swing back the other way a little bit. And they price in cuts one day, they're pricing out cuts the next month or a few months later. So I'm sure there'll be some ebb and flow within all of this. I mean, the one thing I'd add to Patrick's comment on the US, and I think we're broadly aligned on the view, of course, that there's not a recession. We're a little bit concerned. I mean, some of the data has been a bit troubling, I thought, particularly that ISM employment number in the services report last week was particularly poor. And if you took that indicator on its own, you would say, well, we're probably already in recession. So there are one or two things out there that are a bit worrying. The Kansas City Fed Labor Market Index is trending down and is usually a very good predictor of employment. So I think there are things to worry about in the US economy. And it just makes me wonder whether or not maybe later this year, as we ebb and flow through these, you know, pricing in and out of rate cuts, that perhaps later this year we price in a bit more by way of cuts and we get a bit more weakness in the dollar and a bit more of a rally in bonds.
Mm. Patrick, just one area that's sort of been troubling me recently is the convexity of the increase in auto loans and credit card delinquencies, particularly at the sort of the lower income. If you see that, and it's actually reached delinquency rate has reached pre-pandemic levels, but actually the steepness of that curve, the convexity, has actually been increasing, meaning to me there isn't a cat in hell's chance of it's going to stop where it currently is unless they reduce interest rates. So if you're right and the Fed is effectively a bit slow in terms of anticipating the recession or the slowdown, then that's going to blow out, presumably. What's your view? Is that just a sort of, I'm just sort of like looking for problems that don't exist?
Well, that's a problem, and it's been a problem for a generation that the numbers always seem eye-watering and eye-catching in terms of credit card debt, but the U.S. economy keeps going on. It's created a lot of personal strife in households that have that credit card debt. But unfortunately, if you've got credit card debt, the Fed funds rate's irrelevant to you. It's a ridiculous rate you're paying. Something's happened that's led to these decisions. But credit card debt, delinquency on credit card debt, the Fed funds rate, it's almost immaterial versus that. The American consumer is always very confident. It serves them well. They take excessive leverage as a household at times, but it's not a new phenomenon. It's something that seems to be elevated for years and years. There's ebbs and troughs in it, but it is high right now. Government debt's $34 trillion. That's getting very high as well. That's where the move on Fed funds rate and interest rates matter much more than credit card debt. So I think paying $1.5 trillion for interest rate payments for the U.S. government, if interest rates stayed where they were, that would be difficult. More than $1.3, $1.2 trillion if interest rates fall down to where the Fed's talking about interest rates getting, that'll be an incremental benefit that makes debt sustainability a little more manageable anyway.
Yeah. Okay, good. Now just turn in some regions, Harry. So if we're not going to get a recession this year in the US, or unlikely to, what about Europe and the UK? Because we've been bumping around that sort of technical level of zero growth for about 6 months already.
Yeah, I mean, we're already, you could argue on some measures, in some parts of Europe, we're already in recession. There's a lot of, and therefore, I think there's a lot of bad news in the price. I mean, you know, we quite like the UK. And we're looking for...
You're one of the few there, Harry. I'm glad to hear it.
Yeah, well, the UK's been out of favour, along with a lot of Europe, for you know, for a good 5 years or so in terms of underperformance in the equity market. But actually, I think the outlook should improve quite a lot this year and probably next, probably for a couple of reasons. Firstly, we've had this very large contraction in spare post-tax household cash flow in real terms. It's been a big contraction, and I think this year it's probably going to grow quite sharply, given that wage growth is reasonably strong and inflation is falling. There's a fall in mortgage costs coming, there's a fall in household energy bills, so household finances look pretty good in terms of growth in spare cash flow this year. And then I would add to that the second point, which is housing to us looks like it's bottoming out as mortgage rates fall, but also if you look at credit conditions, the availability of mortgage credit is very good in the UK. It's been improving in the last few quarters. And you can start to see some activity, therefore, coming back. If you look at things like new buyer inquiries picking up quite sharply, things like that. So, and these are leading indicators of the housing market, which tell you that house price growth is bottoming out. And I have to say, it's been very resilient anyway, given the move higher in mortgage rates. House prices have held up well, and they're probably going to move higher. I imagine there's a lot of pent-up demand to buy a house in the UK, and lower rates will release a lot of that demand, and I think boost the UK economy. So I think that's a potential surprise for markets as we go into this year.
Good. Okay. Then, and sort of Patrick, putting all that together, if we look at sort of like the US, the UK, and Europe, where are you sort of like putting your money in terms of assets and regions, et cetera, just broadly in terms of equities and bonds and long-term, short-term sort of like, you know, yields, et cetera, but also that sort of regional split as well?
Yeah, so in my global equity portfolio, I've got 52% allocated to the United States. So that's more than half of my portfolio. But my benchmark is 69% US with the MSCI World. So
you're underweight.
The leading companies are, the innovative companies are. They're not priced for perfection, but they're priced for pretty good outcomes. So it is an expensive market where basically American exceptionalism, you can see that in the Magnificent Seven, the mega cap tech stocks. And I still think there's a place for those kind of stocks in most people's portfolios. Not cheap, but incredible quality, resilience. So I don't think you should be chasing them, going massively overweight them, but I do think you can pick and choose the stocks.
Which one would be your preferred play in that sort of Mag 10, Mag 7, et cetera?
The one I don't like is Tesla. The other six, I can make a case for each one of them, that none of them are cheap by any means, but all of them, you have scenarios where their multiples are justified. So I think I'd own the other six. Tesla's just a bit too Elon-driven, and all the great news, I believe, is in the price there. And they are doing incredible things with AI and the self-driving, and these kind of things are going to be a differentiator. So it's not going to be a commodity. It's not going to be an auto company that trades like a GM multiple. But it is trading on a lot of exuberance around the great things Tesla is going to continue to do. And that might be a stock that is priced for closer to perfection, where the other ones are all priced for good things rather than perfect things, I'd say.
Okay, good. And then so outside of the US, you're 52% in the US, and then you're sort of like, how's
Yeah,
that?
so I've got 7% in the UK, which is a small overweight. I've got BAE Systems, I've got Shell. So those are both sectors that I like. The UK's trading near record lows on many multiples. You look at it on it's you can our view is the US economy goes at close to 2%. The UK economy grows at 0.8, maybe up to 1% this year. But there are very many plausible scenarios where both economies grow at a similar level, maybe just short of 2%. So that could be a very good news for the UK because there's more pessimism on the economic outlook. The stocks are undemanding in terms of valuations, and it is a cyclical market. So any good news on the economy, the UK economy benefits from that and the global earnings of the FTSE 100 companies. So I don't have a massive overweight in it, but it is an attractive market in terms of valuation. And if you do have a positive economic view, or at least not a very negative economic view, I don't think those multiples should scare you off.
Yeah, okay. And what about you, Harry? How is sort of long view looking at sort of asset allocation at the top level?
Well, not dissimilar. We are underweight the US. Overall, we're neutral DM equities for the reasons I sort of
Are
alluded to it.
you're underweight the US largely on valuation grounds because it's compared to Europe and the US. I mean, the US is on about 20 times next year, depending on whether you believe the top level strategists or the
Yeah.
bottom level or the analysts, etc. In fact, you can just touch give us a view on that because essentially the top level strategists who seem to preempt where they've got an estimate of where US EPS is likely to head earlier than the bottom up analysts do, etc. They're predicting about 5% EPS growth, whereas the upside from the or from the analysts they're projecting around about 11%. And obviously, if the PE ratio is trading at about 20 times, then that put the PEG ratio at either four or just
Okay.
less than three.
I mean,
But
I
sorry, just
think,
less about two. So there's a big difference.
yeah, and I think 11% is looking very high. And no normally, it's, we should say, when you're in an environment where inflation is falling, operating leverage goes down, pricing power is falling, it's actually very hard to grow top line and therefore hard to grow earnings in that kind of environment. And, if you look through history, it's very hard to find an environment where earnings growth is accelerating like that when inflation is falling. The one exception is the 90s, where you have this very strong productivity, bout of productivity growth and therefore strong earnings. So I think the risk is somewhat to the downside in terms of earnings on in the US.
Okay, good. Well, but big welcome to Edmund Hsing, the CIO at BNP Paribas, who looks pretty stressed actually, because I think he's been struggling to get on, I'm guessing. But how are you doing, Edmund?
I'm actually doing very well, Paul, despite the technological issues I've been suffering, thanks to my company, but finally overcome. I'm on. So,
Okay,
yes.
good. Well, it's we've just been running through sort of the top level view. What's your sort of like view for the capital markets and equities for the rest of the year, given we've had a bit of a sort of damp start and where you're best putting your chips?
Well, obviously, Paul, you've got to put the damn start to this year in the context of the last 2 months of last year, which were fabulous. Fabulous for pretty much everything, whether you talk about equities, bonds, credit, gold. I mean, it's pretty good. Pretty good end of the year. So it's natural we have a bit of a calming down, particularly in stock markets, because we went right back to the highs, right? Right back to the highs on, for instance, the French CAC, the Nikkei in Japan. Latin American indices like the Bovespa in Brazil have been actually continuing to march higher. So there are some places where momentum is very good, others where we hesitate after returning to the highs. And what is interesting is that a lot of, let's say, a lot of the people I speak to are still very conservative, very not really invested in stocks, actually more invested in cash because cash rates are still pretty high. And so far they're staying there. So I think there's still a lot of cash waiting to be invested. However, will it be invested right now? Not so sure. I think, however, that you need to keep a very close eye on certain stock markets which are leading, such as the Nikkei, which is attempting to break to a new multi-year high today. So you say it's a damp start, but the Nikkei is certainly pushing,
What's the
trying to
yen
push.
doing though, Edmund? I bet it's the yen's blowing out, isn't it?
Yeah, the yen has definitely weakened a little bit. There has been a little bit of dollar strength, but you know, that's short term, Paul. If we look medium to longer term, I think we need to recognize the fact that the Nikkei is on a very strong run, part of which is certainly helped by the yen, but not all of which is helped by the yen. So I think there's that. As I said, the Bovespa in Brazil still blowing out to the upside, and I'm really looking at now indices like the French CAC 40 to see if they can mimic these two indices, because if we start to see a broadening of this breaking up to new all-time or multi-year highs on stock indices, then actually we could be in for a fairly decent year. Of course, the FTSE 100 still the laggard right now.
Oh, good. Okay, well, that makes all three of us reasonably positive and optimistic for the rest of the year. Now, Patrick, just let's turn to the day of reckoning, which starts on Friday, which is the US earnings season. And banks are obviously kicking off that. I think we've got JP Morgan and Citibank. What's your sort of like just broad level view of how you think the sort of key messages from that sort of like, you know, the corporate earnings season, and also then just specifically in terms of the banks?
Yeah, so in terms of loan loss provisions, I think they've been very conservative in 2023, that they, like us, they were quite pessimistic on the economy, expected loan losses to happen that haven't really happened. So I think that'll be good news. Trading revenues are always a wild card. And with the market melting up, if they were positioned to be long anything, that could be good news there, because bonds, equities rallying. I think there was a lot of flows as well. So I think that's another part of the earnings that you may get positive on. And M&A on the investment banking side of things, all of those levers, I think, should generate pretty good earnings for the bank. So I'm pretty positive on the bank earnings. We own Citigroup, which is 9x forecast earnings. It is the cheapest of the biggest banks. And
it's still what I can't understand is, why is that valuation just so cheap? Because it's about sort of like, yeah, it's about 0.5 of books still, even though it's gone up 30% in the last 2 months.
Yeah, it's had a good run after a pretty terrible first three quarters of the year. But it's not the best managed bank. You get a management discount for it. It's got a lot of loose ends with small franchises throughout, scattered throughout countries in Asia, that probably, if they could divest those and sell them at a little bit of a premium to where they're trading at, to another bank that's at a higher multiple, I think that might be a strategy to unlock value. But yeah, I expect the earnings announcements to be good from the banks to kickstart earnings. And it probably will flow through, because you've seen Q4 estimates cut, as you always do, as the earnings approach. And that sets the bar that these companies can beat. But the reductions in estimates have been pretty muted versus previous Q4s, actually, that analysts are feeling that they've got to cut some estimates to make sure the company's beat, but not by the same kind of magnitude they have in previous years. So I think that's based on positive reinforcement and guidance the companies are giving these analysts going into the earnings season. So the bottom-up strategists target 3-5% earnings growth, like you said. Top-down are forecasting 11. I think the 3-5 will deliver a pretty reasonable market, because of the buybacks and the dividends you get from the S&P, even right now, give you about a 5% yield. So it's not crazy estimates from the top-down guys, and I think that could be achievable. The bottom-up is probably priced, as it always is, 7-8% too high, too ambitious.
So Harry, Patrick raised a really good point there in terms of if the bottom-up analysts have to cut their estimates in 2024, that means there's going to be profit downgrades and profit warnings, which is unusual, because actually most companies end up beating expectations, certainly in the quarter ahead, maybe not in the year ahead. So if you're going to get some bad news in terms of profit downgrades, that's going to be a bit of a lead. Isn't that going to be a bit of a lead balloon on some companies which are cutting estimates?
Yeah, I think it will, and that's why we need to be quite selective about the stocks and sectors and the regions. And you know, that's why I think you want to move away from the much more expensive parts of the global equity market. And as Patrick said, you know, and we would agree, US equities are super expensive. The positioning is crowded, and that kind of positioning, that kind of pricing, is vulnerable to that sort of negative news flow. So, you know, I think we've got to remember global sector leadership changes typically every 5 to 6 years. And those changes happen when you get big valuation discrepancies and when new macro themes emerge, typically if you look through history. And I think that's where we are today. Super expensive US equity market where positioning is crowded and, you know, very cheap parts of the world in Europe. And as we were saying earlier in the UK, where you look at home builders, you look at the banks, they're much cheaper and vulnerable to positive news flow, not so much the negative news flow.
Yeah. What about you, Edmund, in terms of the sort of key messages from the Q1 results and the banks in particular, sort of like, you know, what you're expecting from a sort of strategic view?
Well, I do think what's probably more important than the Q4 results will be very much the guidance for the year, because you'll start to hear guidance for the year. My guess is the guidance won't be that bad, because if you look at the economic backdrop in the US, it's still fairly decent. Consumption holds up, for one thing. Investment has held up because, of course, you've had a lot of help from the government, from the CHIPS Act, the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act. So that's been a very, you know, big positive, I think, which will likely continue in terms of investment on the non-residential, so the non-real estate side. That should hold up pretty well. In Europe, again, we know there's no growth, but it's not actually getting any worse. If anything, we probably do expect a slow uptick because consumption trends should slowly improve in Europe through the year. Because, of course, you're going to have positive real wage growth as inflation continues to come down. So, you know, at some point, wage growth crosses up above inflation. And then, you know, that should be a positive boon for consumption. So that's what we're expecting. So I don't really expect companies to be giving a lot of negative guidance at this point.
Okay, good. That's positive. And now just turn to one sector, which is, I've been scratching my head, Patrick, is the oil and gas area. And you mentioned you own Shell. And I know it's beaten down, and we've now started to have M&A, which is obviously a good signal for attractive valuations. They are tend to be, you know, share swap deals. They're not actually cash deals, etc. So it's sort of buying at the low, and then you're swapping your shares at the low as well. But what's your sort of outlook for that? Because again, I've been sort of scratching my head in terms of the oil price. It looks pretty soggy, even though you've got geopolitical risk, which says there's too much supply coming on the market.
Yeah, so that's been one of our negative calls for 2023, that I've been overweight energy all year, and it's just the multiples incredibly attractive, the free cash flow generation, the buying back shares, paying dividends. I think all of that continues. OPEC showing a willingness and compliance with their quotas that they're meeting it. So I think our economic view is you get economic growth that drives demand growth. You're getting very strong production out of the United States. But unless we fall in a recession, there's going to be more demand growth than there is supply growth in 2024. And that's going to support prices. I don't know if it's going to lead to spike in prices by any means. But there are exogenous events that can create those price spikes as well. So in a diversified portfolio, it's a bit of a hedge against something happening in Russia, something happening in the Middle East that basically destroys or sanctions on refinings, things like that. So I'm still very much confident in our oil positions. Shell didn't beat the market last year, but it delivered a good positive return. And a shareholder yield of 11.5% is what we calculate right now with dividends and share buybacks for this year.
Yeah, so it's basically just a really good cash generator that looks undervalued. Is that
I don't think you'll get rich, but you'll make a nice positive return on these companies.
I have actually seen BP put out as a takeover target, actually. I can't get my head around that one because I don't know how big it is, $60, $70 billion. But hey, if we go back to those mega deals.
The US integrated companies trade at such premium multiples to European integrated. Yeah. It makes a lot of sense. And if you pay the multiple you're paying on Royal Dutch or BP, and your stock's trading at a 70% premium to that, there's a lot of middle ground that can make those deals look accretive for a US company.
Yeah, good. Okay, Harry, what's your view on the oil sector on that sort of energy side? Do you see the oil? I know because Chris just before Christmas was saying he was negative in terms of the short term, but positive longer term.
Yeah, so we've just added to oil exposure in our strategic portfolio. So that's with a 1 to 2 year horizon. And I think oil's looking very attractive. It's very beaten up certainly starting to look quite technically beaten up now. But we've also had 10 years of very poor investment in the oil and generally in the energy sector. And we've got, a US shale market that is now starting to soften in terms of supply. We've got OPEC pulling together and cutting back on production. And I think if we're right about our sort of no recession scenario this year and perhaps into next, then we're going to have reasonably strong demand growth globally for oil. So, we're looking for a relatively tight market, and I suspect that'll underpin a move higher in the oil price, certainly if we're right about global oil inventories falling because of that tight market.
And Edmund, just let's just put a bow on this energy side, just the renewables and nuclear, because I know this is an area of decarbonisation, which I think you have mentioned before you quite like. What's your sort of view? Because he did get battered last year in terms of the government's deciding to take out subsidies, which I think hit a lot of solar and all wind production, etc. And obviously supply chains are a bit tough as well at the start of the year.
Yeah, but I think things have been a little bit exaggerated on the renewable side. I mean, I would agree on the oil side that things do look fairly tight. Obviously there's been a lot of discussion on the supply side, and that's really what's been dominating, and that's why the oil price is still below $80 a barrel on Brent, because people are worried about the increase in supply, obviously not only from Russia, but also more importantly from US and from other marginal players that have come on the scene, like Guyana, who've come from zero to be a producer. It's a few hundred thousand barrels a day from nothing. But I don't think that's going to last. I think the Permian Basin is actually going to stop showing any sort of production growth, and that's what the EIA themselves are starting to reflect, which suggests to me that the US situation on the supply side in terms of growth is not as great as maybe the market has been projecting. So I would agree that the oil market will get tighter. But of course, coming back to renewables, that's actually good for other sources of alternative energy, because the higher the cost of fossil fuels, the more attractive is, of course, are the alternatives. And we continue to see investment in renewables, and that will obviously continue, because from a geopolitical standpoint, Europe needs it, right? Europe needs it because we're not relying on Russia anymore. And for now, we've largely replaced our reliance on Russian gas with liquefied natural gas. So we are importing a lot of cargoes as opposed to on tankers, as opposed to via pipelines. But that's still not a very comfortable position, because some of that actually still comes from Russia, believe it or not. But also we depend a lot on the US. Yes, don't even ask. But we also depend more heavily on the US and Qatar. And that is not necessarily the best position to be in either from a geopolitical point of view. So alternatives, and I think more solar than wind will continue to see strong growth. And I think, investing in the infrastructure of solar actually makes a lot of sense, whether it be the grids, the battery storage, or solar farms. I think that would make a lot of sense, particularly in Europe.
And what would be the
And
best
aside from
plays? What were the best plays for that, Edmund? Because
yeah,
they've all been absolutely hammered. I mean, they're beating down rock bottom valuation, but
well, that's why it's interesting. I mean, if you look, for instance, at the UK investment trust sector, you find a lot of renewable, or particularly solar, renewable infrastructure trusts, and they are trade on now. Did they trade on premium? A premium to net asset value not too long ago. Now there are discounts, quite sizable discounts. The yield's still good, and I think the medium-term outlook is still pretty healthy as well. So I think that's one way to get some diversified exposure. Otherwise, I would certainly say, coming back to nuclear, I still think I'm still a big believer in the uranium thesis, because I think if you really want good baseload energy on the electricity side, and if we're really forecasting electric vehicle uptake to continue to grow, then you need the electricity. You need the reliable baseload, and renewables will not provide it. And we don't want to rely just on gas and coal. So there really are no other options except nuclear. And you'll see that, for instance, France has changed their tune. Not only are they going to put six more reactors online, that's the project, but now eight additional to those six, i.e., 14. And we hear about Japan restarting nuclear. We hear about China and India installing new nuclear, Poland as well. You have projects all over the world to either extend the lives of existing nuclear power plants or build new ones. And of course, that is even before we talk about small modular reactors, the SMRs, which companies like Rolls-Royce are promoting, which could also be a very good solution, very safe, stable solution for additional nuclear power over the next few years. So I still think that's a very important thing.
Okay, good. Patrick, you mentioned earlier on you've got the civil defence exposure in BAE. What just sort of attracted you? Because the valuations actually still have that sort of like, seem to have a sort of geopolitical risk premium in there. But
well, 15 to 19 times earnings are the basket of stocks we look at, which is a market multiple roughly. Mm. So NATO spending, there's going to be more compliance with that. Europe knows that a Donald Trump presidency, it's definitely a possibility at a minimum. So they may have to go it alone without the US. Just rebuilding of all the arms that have been depleted in these wars as well. So it's not a good view for the world, but it's a good view for these defense stocks. So I think it's a secular tailwind. We're in an environment now with nationalism, protectionism, wars, all of that peace dividend we had for 30 years seems to be dissipating. And I think defense stocks are beneficiaries of this. So again, not incredibly cheap, but structural growth being driving their earnings and revenues.
Yeah, I can't see the Middle East quietening down anytime soon, unfortunately, which is a bit of a tragedy. Now, Harry, let's just run a bit and look on the bond side. What do you see, so sort of like, how do you see the sort of the fixed income side and where to play it, whether it's short term, long term, high yield, whether it's sovereign, whether it's where do you see the best opportunities and which ones to avoid?
Yeah, well, we like long duration. We like US treasuries, 10s, 30s. I think we're back in what we call the age of monetarism. And, you know, you look at when Friedman was writing in the early 70s about monetarism, and you look back at the sort of 100 years before he was writing up his work. And what you saw was that monetarism seemed to work really very well. Whenever you had rapid growth in money supply, you had these big inflation spikes. And whenever money supply contracted, you had deflation. And then for a number of decades, monetarism just stopped working. And I think the reason it stopped was because we went from money creation in terms of putting money in the real economy to money creation happening in commercial banks in terms of mortgage loans. So we didn't have CPI inflation. We had house price inflation. And more recently, we've had asset price inflation as central banks have printed money. But I think we're back now in that age of monetarism environment where central banks created way too much money in the pandemic. We had rapid growth in money supply. And that principally, in our mind, has been the big driver of inflation. And now, of course, we have the opposite. You look around the world in the West, money supply is shrinking very rapidly. And I think it's creating an increasingly large disinflationary impulse, particularly in Western economies and those where they printed a lot of money. And that, I think, is one of the key reasons why you want to own 10s and 30s in long duration in the US, but also more broadly as well in Europe and the UK. And I think there's a lot more downside in those yields as inflation continues to decelerate very rapidly. So I think that's an interesting theme. And that drives a lot of our asset allocation thinking as well in terms of wanting to be overweight some of the defensive parts of the global equity market.
And if that money supply keeps falling, Harry, when are they going to stop doing the QT? Because they've obviously shrunk at about, was it $95 billion per month in the States, and it's down now below $8 trillion, I think, is the Fed's balance sheet. And likewise, they're cutting in the UK as well. But that's putting a bit of a sort of like a sense of gravity down on money supply and inflation.
Yeah, and I think later this year they probably will stop QT. That certainly seems to be the consensus thinking. And there's some chatter, isn't there, about whether or not the bank reserves are plentiful enough, or maybe they're not as high as everyone thinks in reality. And no one's forgotten 2019, we had that blowout in the repo market. So there are risks around carrying on with QT, and at some point, no doubt that will stop. And as I said earlier, I think we're going to see a turn in the credit cycle as rates come down. That might take a little bit of time to feed through, but as the credit cycle turns, money supply growth should then start to reaccelerate. But these things work with relatively long time lags a lot of the time. And I think first, in terms of the sequence of events, we see much weaker inflation and therefore more downside in bond yields.
Okay. Now, if that's right, Edmund, in terms of we do see sort of money supply continuing to shrink, deflation, you know, coming down, etc., then what does that mean for I've actually been a bit of a fan of gold and silver, sort of precious metals, but also that digital gold called Bitcoin that is rocketed last year and is now over $45,000. What's your sort of quick view on both of those asset classes?
Okay, well, I'll deal with the Bitcoin quickly. I have to be honest, a little bit skeptical. I think there has been a huge amount of front running because of the emergence of spot Bitcoin ETFs. And of course, the Bitcoin evangelists will tell you that this is going to, of course, enlarge the take up of Bitcoin amongst more investors who will be able to include it in their diversified portfolios because it'll be easily accessible in ETF format. Well, guess what? Bitcoin futures ETFs already exist. They already exist in the States. Bitcoin ETFs already exist in Europe. So that ain't, you know, European portfolios aren't going to change. US portfolios can already include Bitcoin via the futures. Now, it's true that the futures have not tracked the spot Bitcoin prices maybe you would have liked as well as you would have liked. But still, you would have had very healthy gains if you'd held on to those Bitcoin futures ETFs through last year. So I'm a little bit skeptical it's going to create as big a stir as people make out. I don't think that people's 401k pension plans in the States are suddenly going to be full of spot Bitcoin ETFs tomorrow. And I think so there's that technical issue, which I think risks, yeah, it may be better to fade that as it occurs. And we're very close to that occurring. So that's my feeling there. But on gold, I actually think we're still very close to challenging those all-time highs yet again. And I think there's a good chance we break out, particularly if we're right on the expectation of lower inflation, potentially lower long-term real yields, because that is a very big driver together with the direction of the dollar. If we see a weaker dollar as the Fed cuts rates and we see lower long-term yields, those are both powerful drives for gold. And of course, the third powerful driver is the fact that central banks are still big buyers of gold. They haven't stopped. So there is that source of demand, which has nothing to do with investment.
Yeah. Good. Okay. Well, let's go around the horn in terms of sort of the best sort of like, you know, investment sort of ideas that investors could go away and have a look at. Sort of just, so let's kick off, Patrick. I know there's also, you know, another sector which has been battered is healthcare, et cetera. What's your sort of like your favorite areas for the rest of the year in terms of sort of stock selection?
So our biggest weight in our portfolio is diabetes. It's Novo Nordisk, Eli Lilly's, this play on that as well.
Well, that's done.
Not changing. It's it's the pandemic of the Western world is obesity and diabetes, people living longer, eating too much, and it's getting very fashionable to take Ozempic if you can afford it. And it's showing so many benefits in terms of stroke, heart disease, liver failure, that it's going to become an insurable product, we think, as well, which is really going to widen the usage of it. So healthcare has been beaten up. Those stocks have been good performers. And I do think it's going to be continued tailwind for those kind of stocks. So biggest stock in our portfolio because it's just moved that way because of great performance, but I still think there's a lot of upside in these kind of stocks.
And where else we've got, I mean, I know you own PayPal, don't you, which is value tech, which has sort of like actually come up a bit with the bounce just before Christmas.
Yeah, so that, I think it was down at $50 at the end of October. It's up at $62 now. It's a cheap stock. People use PayPal more than they realize because the bulk of the growth and the revenues now are coming from unbranded transactions. And it's a stock that I own. It's not incredible. It's going to face competition, but it's not being priced like it has a monopoly or an oligopoly position at all anymore. So it is a cyclical company, transaction orientated, but trading at less than 10 times earnings, it's a stock that I'm still very comfortable with.
Yeah. And which one would be your sort of favorite for this year, would you say? I know it's a big ask, et cetera, but would you say people should go and have a look at?
Canadian Natural Resources, or are you talking on tech or on?
No, anywhere.
I'll go CNQ in Canada. So yeah, I do think the U.S. Production is peaking and they're going to need pipelines and get oil from Canada. It's much more politically, I think, achievable that you, instead of getting Venezuelan oil, Middle Eastern oil, Canadian oil, approvals of pipelines and Canadian companies trade at big discounts to the US. So I do think there's going to be acquisitions of Canadian companies from US companies. So you've already seen some acquisitions in the energy space. I do think it's going to turn a little bit more multinational in 2024.
Good. What about you, Harry? What's your sort of like your best areas? I know you can't particularly stock pick, but just sort of like where you mentioned sort of the battered areas, but where would you sort of like highlight to investors would be that they should go hunting?
Yeah, I mean, as I say, I like the home builders, we like the banks, we like these cyclically sensitive areas.
The UK home builders, not the US ones, I guess.
Yeah, the UK, yeah, for sure. I think also we're going to see a lot of dollar weakness, a lot more dollar weakness this year. Sentiment still quite bearish. It's generating a contrarian sales signal. The market's been very long, the dollar. So a lot of that's unwound now, but I think there's probably more to go. I think you know, the yen has a bigger move in it. So much more weakness in dollar yen, and with plenty of downside, I think, to come.
And why the strength in the yen? Is that because they're going to the Bank of Japan is going to throw out the yield curve control?
There might be some of that. I think principally it'll be a play on lower bond yields, lower real yields in the US. I mean, there's a pretty high correlation. And because it's a higher level, there's more movement. And so generally it's the US that drives that part of us, or drives the spread more so than the Japanese side. But generally, I think, you know, there's, as I said earlier, the story is sector rotation away from expensive US stocks that are crowded and towards Europe and probably towards Japan as well. And I think that's what's quite interesting. And this sort of touches on something Edmund mentioned earlier, which is this idea that you can get a rally in the Nikkei, but you could also continue to see weakness in dollar yen at the same time. That hasn't been the setup over the last few years, but there are times in history where that happens. The early noughties is a good example of that. So we quite like the Nikkei, and I think that will perform well this year.
Good. What about you, Edmund? I know you've been a bit of a fan of sort of small or SMID cap type shares, because they were battered last year and still a long way from their highs, that's for sure. Whereas the mega seven are have been zooming through them.
Yeah, I think that just to pick up on the Japanese side, I think actually one interesting way to play Japan, and as you know, I've been a big fan of Japan and it's worked very nicely. I would still play Japan. I think there's still plenty of upside. But one interesting twist on that, as you mentioned, small caps, might be to invest in a Japanese small cap fund. There exist funds and ETFs, funds and investment trusts in Japanese small cap. And this is one way of sidestepping the currency issue, because as you say, there's always the feeling that large caps tend to be more exporters and benefit from a weaker yen and suffer from a stronger yen. Well, think about this. If consumption remains pretty decent, and it has been pretty decent in Japan, you are getting price increases now because they actually have positive inflation in Japan for the first time in goodness knows when.
Yeah.
So that is, and so you're actually seeing profit margins coming up, domestic profit margins coming up quite nicely. And Japanese small caps, which are of course very cheap, as with much of the Japanese market, could be a good way to play that, which actually won't suffer from a stronger yen, because they're not so export dominated. They're much more domestically focused. So that can be one way to play that. I think elsewhere, for instance, in UK and Europe, you really want to wait for a bit of a pickup in the economy, because it's interesting when you look at the
you're going to be waiting a long time then, Edmund.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so, Paul. I think everyone's unduly pessimistic.
So when do you think the pickup's going to be?
I think it's going to be in the next few months, honestly. Yeah. Because let's take the Eurozone. We're already bumping along at zero anyway. So there is no growth. But I think as inflation comes down, as I said, wage growth continues to remain pretty resilient, and unemployment is not really going up, you're going to see consumption rebound, right? Because people have been smacked across the head by these very high prices, and so they spend less, which is normal, right? When you feel you're not getting value for money, you tend to trade down a bit. You're not going to be big buyers on volume at times like that. But as the inflation comes back down, you tend to find bargains, and then you spend a bit more. And that's exactly what we're seeing. And I think that could underpin a bit of consumption growth in the UK as well as in Europe through this year. And I think in the UK, again, bear in mind that if yields come down, then two-year fixed mortgage rates will come down further. They have come down already from the peak.
Yeah.
They will come down further. And that will also provide some well, you know, some welcome relief to the property markets. And as we know, the wealth effect in Europe and the UK is predominantly driven by the property market. If that stops going down, and maybe even, and remember, prices have been inching up in the UK, property prices, by and large, so which is quite surprising. Yeah. But again, the lower that those two-year fixed rate mortgages come down, the better the affordability, and the more, I think, the more stability we'll see in the property market, which will, in, again, also help confidence and consumption. So I'm a little bit of a contrarian there, and I think the UK mid and small cap space looks excellent value to me. It has been very neglected, both because it's UK and because it's mid small cap. And I think any pickup in the sort of economic activity will be reflected pretty quickly in these stocks. And on top of that, of course, you have the whole M&A aspect. There is no doubt we're going to see more takeouts of UK mid and small caps through the year. So again, it's always a bit of a, it's a difficult game to try to pick the candidates, and everyone starts the year trying to pick their candidates. I prefer just to pick quality companies with good niches that may or may not become candidates, but they have very solid fundamentals behind them anyway, and are trading on a cheap multiple.
Good. Okay, well, thanks very much, guys. That's a good optimistic place to finish today's sort of discussion. And let's see how we get on when we chat in 3 months' time. So thanks again, guys, and appreciate your insights.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.